All right, so welcome everyone to the call, and thank you for being here. I am truly honored by your presence. I know that there's a lot of things you could be doing with your life and with your time right now, but as it's been said, you know, there's 80% of success is what? It's just showing up. So you showed up tonight. Thank you very much. I am totally honored, and I'm honored that you're part of our Leap Mastermind coaching process. Tonight, of course, is a special call. It's not one of our mandatory calls. It's not one of the Leap Mastermind coaching process calls, but tonight is a very special call. Nonetheless, we're going to be speaking with a gentleman who's on a journey, who has, number one, taken a massive leap several times in his life, but certainly one very notable experience in the recent past, and continues. One of the things that we've talked about, we've just barely scraped the surface on, is what I call the leap continuum. You'll remember when I introduced that to you a few weeks ago. And the leap continuum, of course, is, you know, as we make our journey, we have our journey first from base camp through body rapport, brutal honesty, overcoming the temptation, the dragon, and finally getting to the summit where we're going to take that massive leap of faith in our life. We're going to change something in some way, leave something behind, and move towards something new. And it's going to require that leap of faith. But it's only from that summit and from that leap that you can then see what's next. What's the next highest summit for you? Because you can't see it at the bottom. You can't see it from where you are. What your journey is in the next phase can barely be imagined, much less seen from where you are right now. And Mark is at that place right now, where I'm going to be introducing you to our caller in just a moment. He's in a place right now where he's taken that massive leap and has been able to see what's next, the next highest summit, that he's now embarked on the journey of reaching that summit, making it to the peak, you might say, both physically, mentally, emotionally, and certainly spiritually as well. And that's where we are in our lives as well. We're making our way up to the summit where we're going to leap, change something. You've identified what that is. Mark Eisenhart has done that. He's in the process of doing it again. So let me introduce you to my very dear friend and someone I think is going to inspire all of us to continue this journey upward to our leap space. Mark Eisenhart, thank you so much for joining us, brother.
Thanks so much for having me on the call, Tom, all the way. And thank you so much for your introduction and for being, you know, who you are and doing what you do. Your work is integral not only to me but to so many other people who are on this journey and looking for the tools they need in their toolbox to be successful with this. You're an expert strategist and an expert tactician. And I'm just going to say, just real quick as an aside, I'm actually going to be over in Venice Beach tomorrow, Marina Del Rey. So I'll certainly say hi to everybody over there for you, or at least say hi to the neighborhood and stop by Gold's Gym on your behalf.
Absolutely. I still love it out there. We were out there a few months ago, actually, and I love it. I just love the area. I love the community. It's vibrant, it's alive, it's spiritual in many respects, and it's just so much fun. I just can't take the traffic, man. I mean, we were in our car, and we were, you know, you see so many gorgeous, exotic cars that just be fun to drive. I mean, we pulled up next to this burnt orange Lamborghini while we were in traffic, and we realized that these Lamborghinis, this thing can go from 0 to 5 miles an hour in about 3 seconds. I mean, it's just amazing. But that was about the top speed it got to while we were in traffic. So I don't know how you deal with it, but somehow you deal with it, man.
Right.
So you know, I gave you a brief introduction, but I barely skimmed the surface. There's so many things in terms of the details, in terms of what you've been through, where you've come from. And I did introduce you a little bit in an email that went out to everyone, inviting them to be on this call. And we talked about the weight component. You coming down from well over 400 pounds to where you are now, 240, and the next leg of the journey. Why don't you share a little bit of your story, and then we'll kind of break it down a little bit in terms of where that leap started, how it started, what were the steps along the way that you took, and what's the process as you continue to move forward. So why don't you share with us your story a little bit, Mark?
Well, thanks, Tom. So just in brief, I'm a guy I've been an athlete my whole life. I played football and wrestled and high school and college and played for a short time in the minor leagues with the Portland Raiders. And I worked in outdoor recreation and leadership when I was younger, in my late 20s and early 30s. I worked as a paramedic firefighter. So, you know, there have been times in my life when I've been in excellent shape. But I'm also a guy who struggled with an eating disorder and with yo-yoing and managing my weight. And and not being able to stay in the kind of shape that I wanted to be in or needed to be in for sustainable periods of time. So in brief, I'd say probably the biggest culprit, although there are a lot of things that contributed to what happened with the downward spiral that was eventually what caused my life to spin out of control, PTSD is probably the biggest thing that I would point my finger at, post-traumatic stress disorder, because, you know, like, I worked for the largest fire protection district in the state of Oregon as a medic firefighter and a hazmat technician, and before that I worked in the Bronx in New York City with New York City EMS as an extern, and I did my internship in the Massachusetts General Hospital, which is a level one trauma center. And like all good, you know, alpha males back then, all good warriors, I had what I call male immortality syndrome, and I was convinced, you know, that everything was going to roll off me and nothing would get to me, and I was absolutely dead wrong. So basically all those years of not dealing with all the stress of being in the workforce and doing what I was doing started to pile up, Tom, and I was still dealing with the eating, or rather not dealing with my eating disorder and the other things that were comorbid to that. So things like anxiety and depression, and, you know, those things don't go away. They don't just dissipate in the atmosphere. They pile up, and if you don't deal with them, they start dealing with you. So they did. In my mid to late 30s, things took a real, real sharp turn down into darkness for me, and to add gasoline to a diesel fire, I watched my dad, who was my best friend, my hero, my true north, my greatest teacher, beat cancer to die of liver disease. And that experience absolutely gutted me. So although things were already really somewhere between bad and worse, it got really ugly because I started abusing drugs and alcohol. And, you know, I made a conscious choice to just see how far I could run my life into the ground, Tom, and I succeeded brilliantly. So at the time of my rock bottom, man, I was at death's door. I wasn't living anymore. I was dying.
Well, we certainly can understand, and anyone who's ever been around, anyone who's been in, you know, a first responder, particularly in a place like New York City and many of the other places you were a firefighter in. My brother was a police officer in New York City. He was a transit officer out there, and he spent a lot of time down in those subways. And ultimately, you know, as strong as my brother was and as strong as you are, it will catch up to you, especially when you had some of those traumatic experiences. If you've seen trauma again and again and again, it has an indelible mark on your consciousness that will affect how you do and infect everything you do in many respects. So, you know, turning to drugs and alcohol and even food at that point is certainly understandable. And really the question is then the turning point. Because we understand this. We understand how this could happen. In fact, in our own lives, it doesn't necessarily have to be post-traumatic stress disorder. It could be something else that we coded as stress that took place years ago, perhaps when we were a young child, for example, that we're still living with or still forming many of our beliefs and our actions based on. So there's a lot of things that go into our lives that make up where we are right now. And sometimes that place where we are is a struggle. It's difficult. It's a challenge. It's something that has to change. You hit that point, Mark. You hit that point where you were, as you called it, dead bottom. Yeah. What was it? I mean, that obviously is a critical turning point, but not for everyone. Not everyone turns from that. Some people stay there and die there. What was it that turned you? What was it that had you take a leap forward in your life to make some changes? What was it that really made the critical difference at that point?
The biggest thing for me, Tom, honestly, so what I did right after my dad's death, right, I wanted to be a pillar of strength for my mom and my sister and my family, so I defaulted back to my training as an emergency services professional and kind of just went into crisis management mode, which was very, you know, I was very good at, so I was able to push through that. And then after everything was done with my dad, I went home. I literally collapsed, Tom, in the privacy and safety of my own home. I'll be frank, I curled up in the fetal position, and I just lost it. And I just said, you know what, I'm just not going to do this anymore. This is not who I am. The biggest thing was, Tom, I had gotten as far away from being myself, what I call my true and authentic self, as I could possibly be. I'd gotten as far away from that as I could. And I promised myself, And most importantly, I promised my dad, let me go on record as saying that my dad was an extraordinary man, and I had an extraordinary relationship with him. And this man did not let me down one time in 40 years. If he said he was going to be somewhere, he did it. Or rather, if he said he was going to be somewhere, he was there. If he said he was going to do something, he did it. And so I vowed to reciprocate in kind. I vowed to make sure that I was not only going to drop the weight and get healthy, but I was going to restore myself to the kind of vibrant health that I enjoyed during my prime when I felt like I was closest to being my true and authentic self. And I made that vow to myself and my dad, or to die trying. So it was really, really, I mean, there were different things that kind of played into it. I mean, it was only a matter of time before I had a massive heart attack, and I didn't have that choice, Tom. But when I still did have the choice, what I did was I reflected, I turned inward, and I thought to myself, you know what? This is not who I am. I am not my father's son. And I am going to do this, or I'm going to die trying. I'm going to do it for me, and I'm going to do it for him in a way that honors his memory and honors my family. And that was it. That was the crux of it right there. That's the biggest thing.
Fantastic. And you know what's interesting? You mentioned that, and you said the authentic self. You were as far from your authentic self as you could have been. You were not being your father's son, who you identified with, who was a champion in your life in many respects. We don't all have that privilege, you might say, of having parents that were truly our heroes in many respects. Many of us do, certainly on this call. But I want to go back to this authentic self, because this is a real key component in what we're going to be learning, guys, in terms of this leap experience. In terms of one of the key elements is, of course, the core truth, which is brutal honesty, being brutally honest with yourself. And this authentic self represents the core truth of who we really are. So how did you know? Because this is something that everyone's going to wrestle with here at some point on this call, Mark. How did you know? How do you know when you're not being authentic? How do you know when you're not in your core truth? For you, I mean, there may have been something. What is it? A message? Is it just something that you intuitively know, you understand when you look in the mirror? What was it that told you you're not being authentic, you're not being in your core truth, and not being who you really are?
So Tom, you've nailed it, man. I mean, for me, it's just I had gotten glimpses at different times in my life of what it felt like to be in alignment with my true and authentic self, and that manifested in different ways in my career. For example, I was decorated in the first year I worked with the fire service with a Medal of Valor and a Community Service Award for heroism for something that I did off duty. This was a moment where I felt like I got a glimpse at what I considered to be my true and authentic self. Now, let me step back and say that one of the things that I talk about in my book, my first book, and this is a core belief that I have, is that life is a Rorschach test, Tom. Anais Nin said that we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are, right? But I had seen at different times in my life, I had gotten glimpses at what I considered to be my true and authentic self, and there were times when I felt like it was very much in alignment with that. So in that moment of desperation and what eventually became a moment of great strength at that time after my dad's death, I reflected back on those moments in my life when I felt like this is who I am. This is who I'm meant to be. This best reflects my true and authentic self. And I still, the metric that I hold myself to, is there are two things above all else that I use when I ask myself. I look in the mirror, even now, every night, and I say, would this have made my dad proud today if he was alive? And did my behavior today best reflect who I am? That's the metric that I use. So since I'd had glimpses of that at different times in my life, and I believe, like you, that, you know, we're the creators. We're essentially recreating ourselves every second of every minute of every day. What I vowed to do back then, Tom, was take all those little bits and pieces, all those little glimpses at different times in my life, and assemble them and use them as a foundation that ultimately, this time around, what I was going to do was create and maintain the best, most authentic version of who I am that was possible. And that was more than just weight loss and eradicating the diseases. That was everything. Because as you know, one of the things that I'm so grateful for, the work that we're doing together, is I'm applying that same degree of enthusiasm and intensity and fortitude and commitment to every other aspect of my life, especially and including my career, to become the best, most rounded, most integrated, most authentic version of myself, my true self.
That may be one of the best and clearest explanations and or descriptions of finding your authentic self in terms of how do you identify that? Because that's a tough question. I know I was asking a difficult question. How do you know? How do you know when you're not being your authentic self? How do you know who your authentic self is? And many people, and you know this. You know this is true, that a lot of people ask themselves this question. Who am I? Who am I? What's my role? What's my purpose? What's the meaning? I mean, all of that. And you said something that was so important, and this is something I really want everyone to get here, especially as we move into being brutally honest with ourselves, is that this compass, I think we all need to identify, number one, what is our compass? What is our true north? For Mark, obviously, he stated that it's his dad in many respects. He was just always, when he was younger and growing up, his dad never let him down. His dad was always there. He was a man of integrity. And whether you have that role model in your life or not, we need to find that role model. We need to find it. Seek it out. It's in yourself as well, by the way. And measuring yourself, having a compass that creates a north for you, and the idea of assembling, because we've all had this remark. I've had this experience where, you know, man, that was me. I felt you step up. And sometimes there's consequences to stepping up, yeah? I mean, there's a price to it. And it hurts sometimes, and you've got to sacrifice other things. When you step up and you be your core truth, and you do something that says, this is who I am. And we've all had those moments. Sometimes they're scattered, they're not close together, maybe they're years apart, maybe they're not as frequent as we'd like, but they've been there, and they will continue to be there. And when you talked about assembling them to be the best, to create a model for the best that you can be, and that's what you live, that's what you at least strive to live, that's powerful, man. And that's what I want everyone to get from this.
Well, thank you, Tom, and thank you very much for the question, because it's such an integral question. I mean, let's face it, we are the creators, but we're constantly, it's a dynamic, it's a fluid more than it is a solid, where we're creating ourselves every second of every minute of every day. But there's a core there. There's a core value system. There's a core set of beliefs. And just what's implied in there, as I reflected back on what you said in my original answer, is just the very fact, Tom, that I have that willingness to look at myself in the mirror. Because let me tell you something, for a long time in there, I wouldn't go anywhere near the mirror to look at myself. Mm-hmm. Or when I did, I had my head down. But just the fact that I have that willingness and I do it, it's almost like it's a no-brainer to me now. It's second nature. But when I do, Tom, I recognize myself. I recognize myself. I have that confidence, and I don't look away. I don't look down. I don't avert my eyes. And the reason I do is because this reflects who I am, and I recognize those qualities in myself.
Yeah. Wow. That's critical. I want to get into something that's even more tangible and less abstract. And you gave us some great examples that bring it down into something that's more concrete that we can actually get a hold of in terms of this core truth and in terms of this authentic self and living our true north and authentic with that. I want to get into something that's really, truly tangible. That is the physiology component. Because certainly part of the process that we're learning along the way that I'm sharing with our mastermind group is this, in the importance of what I call body rapport. And that in many respects, it begins. The journey begins with an awareness. It begins with a looking in the mirror. It begins with understanding that something needs to change. And that fetal position for you, and finally getting up from there and taking action. And I know one of the first actions you began to take was with your physiology. And I call it body rapport. But let's talk about the physical transformation, the beginning of that physical transformation, the mindset that went into that, and how that all sort of evolved, you might say.
Well, I'm so glad that you came back to that because, man, let me tell you something. That's where the leap of faith came in, Tom, because let me tell you, man, at 455 pounds, what I had was a foundation, a belief system that was based on distortional beliefs. and apocryphal truths. When I looked at myself in the mirror, I saw, you know, anything but what I really am, my true and authentic self. I could not even for a second imagine getting back down to 240 pounds. Like I said, there's been times in my life when I was in excellent shape. But at 455 pounds, man, I had to take a leap of faith just to get my head around the possibility that I could be 15 pounds lighter or 30 pounds lighter, right? So it was a matter of, first of all, identifying right off the bat that I had a distortional belief system. In the interview we had the other night, you talked about my model of the world and my model of where I fit in with that, right? So I had to have that willingness to deconstruct that. And in order to do that, I first had to have the willingness to realize that maybe it was all turned inside out. It was distortional in the first place. It all started up in my head. And I was, you know, in addition to the weight problem I had anxiety, depression, OCD. So I had to have enough lucidity and enough sanity, I guess, for lack of a better term, to be able to recognize that I had a distortional view of myself in order to be willing to get to the other side of that through that process of dismantling. But let me tell you, man, I was making that decision even then with a diseased mind. But I did. I got to that point where I said, okay, I know I can do this. I know that it's possible. Now I have to do, all I have to do is jump and trust that the net will appear. The how it works out, the details, the when, the where, the methodology, all that stuff, it will show up for me. I just have to have that willingness, and it had to start with knowing and believing that it was possible. So that's where it started with me, and I did it very much in little increments. You know, I had to. I lost an entire person in a year, and so it started first with that willingness to kind of and so one of the things that I did actually was I went naturally and rummaged through photo albums and stuff, right, Tom, to find pictures of when I was lighter and in great shape, and I went back into, you know, pictures from when I played football, and I put them up. I'm such a visually oriented person, Tom, and I had to get those images back into my subconscious mind. I had to do a little bit of, I don't want to call it brainwashing, but that was what was necessary because I couldn't quite get there in my imagination yet, so I had to put some line of sight sort of affirmations in front of me in order for me to be able to make that first leap of faith.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it, in many respects, once you've made the decision, and the decision was, in large part, was just accepting a belief that, number one, it was possible.
That's right.
Because like you said, I mean, just the idea of dropping 15 pounds at 455 pounds, that was challenging enough, which barely put a dent in it. But the idea of losing an entire human being, well over 100 pounds, in the course of a year or so, is going to require at least a belief that it's possible. Would you accept the premise that if you believed that it was impossible, you couldn't have begun the journey? Yes,
absolutely, Tom. What I was going to tell you is that, you know, right there, it was that core. I had to have that willingness to take a good hard look at a core belief that I had that turned out to be a distortional belief, because I had talked myself into, the reason I had gotten into that place in the first place is because I gave up. I had deluded myself into thinking there was no turning back. You know, and you know how the universe works. The universe will conspire to help you in whatever you intend to create for yourself. So what I was successful in creating for myself was, you know, death's door, was the hell of my own manifestation. And so what I had to do is have that willingness to go, okay, what if in this moment right now, this core belief that I have is wrong? What would that mean? I didn't say, you know, I can get to the other side of this, I can lose 100 pounds, I can whatever. Because I told everybody who was really close to me, including a panel of physicians, what I was intending to do, and they said it's impossible. And I said, watch this. But I had to get to that point where I decided, almost like a double negative in a way, I guess, Tom, what if this core belief that I have that's making up this foundation, excuse me, this foundation for what's in my head, what if it's wrong? What does that mean? Right? So I had to kind of approach it from that angle, and then sure enough, once I did that, then all the possibilities that are out there, that existed anyway, but they were in my blind spot, Tom. I couldn't see them. Once I got to that point, all those possibilities started showing up, and I was able to shrink my blind spot.
Well, any journey begins first with that, the right question. You had to ask yourself the right question, and that was an empowering question. And guys, this is something that's important as well. Start to listen to the questions you're asking yourself. And that little inner voice. What Mark brought out a moment ago was he's very visual, too. And, you know, listen, our emotions show up in our internal dialogue in many respects. Our beliefs show up in our internal dialogue. They manifest into emotion. Those emotions manifest into our action, and ultimately that leads to our what? Our results, right? So what he said was so listen. If you're listening to what's going on in your mind, what kind of questions you're asking yourself, what kind of decisions you're making, what's that internal dialogue that's going on, it'll start to reveal something like what Mark perhaps discovered, which was this distortional belief that he calls it, that had to be questioned. What if this isn't true? What if it's false? And then the mind begins to fill in the blank about that, starts to create a model for what does that look like if it is false. What are the possibilities at that point?
Yeah.
And that's where the journey began, yeah?
Absolutely, Tom. And let me tell you something. I started working what was integral to my transformation back then and still an integral part of who I am is meditation and that willingness to quiet the mind and find that emptiness. But let me tell you, the very first time that I started working with a Shambhala-style Buddhist teacher to start learning how to do Shambhala or Buddhist-style meditation. And the very first time that I told my teacher what was going on and what was coming up for me around those belief systems and those thoughts, he looked at me and he smiled and he said, "Mark, don't believe everything you think." And let me tell you something, Tom. I wish you could have seen the look on my face because all of a sudden it was like, oh, my God, is it that simple? I mean, it does. Just because I believe something is true doesn't make it true. So I had to go. It was just that willingness, right, to get to that point where, like, oh, crap, what if I'm wrong? What if I've invested all this energy into turning these thoughts I have into beliefs? Because what that means is I've created a system of distortional beliefs and apocryphal truths. And that is the reason that I'm right here right now where I'm at rock bottom. So absolutely, Tom, integral. What if you don't believe, or rather, what if you're wrong? And the take-home message here is don't believe everything you think. I got a hold of that subconscious mind, and I, you know, once I started getting into that deeper, then, you know, positive thoughts were replacing negative thoughts, and then the whole, you know, flow of energy totally changes with emotions, with behavior, everything.
Yeah. That's the journey. That's the leap in many respects. And understanding that, asking the right questions, recognizing the beliefs that are distorted. And many of those, that internal language, and many of those beliefs also come from what we're going to be talking about in this process, which is, you know, we talked about the core truth, the authentic self. But how are you living if you're not living your core truth? In many respects, we're living what I like to call, and this comes from Buddhist teachings as well, which is the crusty truth. Like the Buddha, like the golden Buddha that had been covered in mud and crust for so many hundreds of years, and it was finally discovered to be this incredible statue. You've been covered with crust, the crust that you yourself created. You piled it on after years and years and years of creating beliefs, making decisions, and then validating those decisions, years and years and years of crust. That's the internal language. Those are the beliefs you've been living. So it's time to start questioning all of that and chipping away at that crust to reveal the gold, the precious you, the precious, magnificent, authentic self that you are, as Mark is doing, has done, that we're all on this journey, by the way. Few of us ever fully chip away at all the crusty truth. Every now and again, some of that distortion starts to seep into our consciousness and our thoughts again. But the key is to be aware of it. And as Mark talked about, meditation is a critical component of that, to being able to silence the mind and allow new thoughts, new beginnings, new beliefs to start to manifest from there. So one of the things I want to talk about, Mark, is from that point on, that physical journey began in this respect. What was the first step? Because, you know, I mean, there's so many different things we can do. Meditation is a physical, psychological, a mental, and emotional approach. But is there exercise? Was it getting back into the gym? Was it movement? And how did you really start to connect? Because obviously, I mean, this almost goes without saying, but I'm going to say this because it's so important to this leap process in terms of the body rapport component. What does body rapport mean? Remember, guys, it's to know, like, and trust your body. It's obvious that at 455 pounds, Mark no longer knew, like, and trusted his body. He couldn't even look at his mirror in the mirror at it. So how did it begin? How did that trust begin again, Mark, in terms of getting back in and rebuilding the body and rebuilding the trust and the liking of your body? How did that all start?
So, Tom, real quick to address something you said about body rapport. Now that I have done this, and even though I'm embarking on a second transformation now, now that I've done this, man, before I was the poster child for body dysmorphic disorder, right? But now that I've done this deconstruction and this dismantling, I finally have, for the very first time in my life, a very healthy, a very empowering, a very realistic idea, model in my own head about what the best version of myself will look like from a from a physiological point of view. So it's so great and so liberating to finally be able to know what that looks like. Because before, I had that distortional, that dysmorphic disorder and everything. I was, like, the archetypes I was using were like graphic novels and comic books. And now I have a very clear-cut idea in my mind of what the best, most physically fit, healthiest version of me will look like. And then to answer your question, well, the most important thing was the meditation, but then what I did was I created an immersion program for myself, Tom. I decided, okay, I'm going to use a Jason Bourne approach, if you will, anything and everything that's necessary that's around me that I need to in order to make this work. So right away, lifestyle changes right away. At 455 pounds, I was living a horribly sedentary lifestyle. In fact, I had become nocturnal. So one of the very first things I did was commit to resetting my biorhythm, to getting back on a regular sleep cycle. Because you and I both know right away how much stress creeps in there and cortisol hormones. It all gets out of whack when your sleep cycle's out of whack. And I was turned inside out. I was leading a totally sedentary lifestyle. My sleep cycle was totally turned inside out, so I reset that. Lifestyle changes to little things as simple as just trying to go from a sedentary lifestyle to exerting myself more. Things like, you know, we hear this all the time, but it does work. If I was going to go somewhere, I would use mass transit or walk or, you know, park further away from the door when I was going to somewhere, and I would just gradually increase my activity levels. I did start doing things like that, and it did start working. I wasn't, you know, anywhere near being in the kind of shape where I could really even exert myself for any length of time, but then incremental changes in my diet. I first took out all the processed foods, literally went into my kitchen, started throwing stuff away, anything that had high fructose corn syrup in it, anything that had white flour, white sugar, any processed food, anything that was questionable, took it out of there. I eventually did a cleanse in there to kind of, you know, my pipes were all clogged up and I had to declog them. So everything was gummed up and I did a cleanse. So it was a combination of those things. And then, you know, what it was too, a lot of, is just surrounding myself with people who were healthy. The energetic law of attraction has proven that like attracts like. And those people are, they're walking their talk. They're modeling those behaviors. So I would start, you know, kind of inventorying the people that I was spending time with. And if I was previously hanging around somebody who was engaging in behavior or habits that were contrary to my goals, I just created an environment where I could stay on track. And that meant, unfortunately, not hanging around some people that I had been hanging around with, or maybe even people that I called my friends. But it became readily obvious to me I needed to change my environment some of the time. Or if I found myself in an environment that was contrary to my goals, I got out of there in a heartbeat.
Well, that's a big one for many people. I mean, in terms of people that are struggling with alcohol, with smoking, with lack of activity, lack of exercise, lack of movement, you know, you reflect the people that you surround yourself with. We know that is true with income levels as well. So, I mean, the environmental thing, I mean, if you look at some of the work that Daniel Goldman has done in terms of, you know, emotional intelligence, understanding even how cells respond to other cells in petri dishes. It responds in like to its environment. And our cells do the same thing, Mark, and you understand this stuff. You knew it on an intuitive level. This is a place to begin. Changing my environment is a critical component to that.
It was critical, and it's still, you know, you don't fish for trout in the duck pond. You don't be in an environment where you're going to be triggered around people or behaviors or whatever, because that's just going to take you off your plan. So that was integral. I definitely had to kind of inventory the people that I was keeping company with, and I spent a lot of time talking to people who had been successful with weight loss and transformation in the long term, and kind of picked their brains a little bit, found out what worked for them. And later on, I started using other modalities in addition to meditation, techniques like emotional freedom technique, Reiki, and other forms of energy work. And I want to go on record as saying that I think it was a combination of the fact that I created an immersion program, but specifically, I was hitting my body with variable stimuli from the standpoint of healing modalities. And like when you're in the gym and training, and the body adapts obviously to any training program or routine over time, so you bring in things like shock training or interval training to stimulate muscle growth and to force the body to adapt, I took the same kind of approach when it came to healing. So sometimes I would do Reiki, sometimes I would do craniosacral therapy, sometimes I would do emotional freedom technique, you know, just different modalities I think contributed to me being as successful as I was in the time that I was.
Yeah, I think the key here, and this is interesting because next week we're about to launch into creating an intuitive action plan for our physiology, for reestablishing rapport. Now, many on our call are already athletic and athletes, and guys, this doesn't exempt you from creating this intuitive action plan, because in many respects, even athletes, to some degree, have disengaged from the rapport of their body. When I was bodybuilding, for example, it was always about pushing past the pain barrier and learning not to listen to the body. In many respects, because the body would tell me, it's time to rest, it's time to take a break, slow down. No, I'm in training. So athletes, you are not exempt from this, and what we're going to be embarking on next week is exactly what Mark is talking about in terms of his self-designed immersion program. You're going to be creating your own intuitive action plan in terms of what we need to do, what you need to do specifically to re-engage with your body, to start honoring your physiology. Mark said something that was really interesting, that, you know, he started to develop a model for, or began to realize there was a model for his best self physically. And it's interesting because the unconscious mind has that model already. We just blind ourselves to it. We cut ourselves off from listening to it in many respects. We lose rapport, just like a lover. You shut a lover up often enough, they're either going to start screaming at you or slap you in the face or just stop communicating. And our body does the same thing. Mark began this process, number one, of resetting his sleep cycle. And then, you know, changing just some subtle lifestyle things. And then the diet, changing the environment. All this began to develop a rapport. And this goes directly to the question of how did you redevelop that rapport? Because at 455 pounds, Mark, I mean, you cut off communication with your body. Everything it was trying to tell you that was intuitive to its unconscious model of what health and wellness is for your physiology was completely blacked out or blocked off. So you really, you went through this process, and guys, we're going to go through the same type of process. You're going to decide. I'm not going to decide. This is Mark. Really couldn't have anybody else decide for him. He had to make some decisions around that himself in terms of what his program was like in that respect. Is that accurate, Mark?
That's absolutely spot on, Tom. Absolutely. You know, no one can tell you who you are. You know, and it's interesting, Tom, because my whole life really, I've been in the pursuit of discovering and in the pursuit of being self-actualized. In my book, I talk about two words that have been just integral to my life, the Latin phrase tem et nosce, know thyself. My whole life, I've been in the pursuit of discovering myself and being self-actualized. So this process and what came as a result of taking that leap of faith and then the deconstruction and dismantling that followed really provided me with, among other things, not only the road back to health, but the road to really discover who and what I really am, to be as self-actualized as I could possibly be. Now, that again is a moving target, right? Because by saying it, I've just recreated who I am. But it's a process, and once you realize that, you know, it's a fluid and not a solid, then you're always going to be rediscovering and recreating yourself and in that cycle and in that loop. But that's the place to be, and nobody can tell you who you are. You have to discover that for yourself.
Right on, absolutely. So here's something I want to talk about, because you've started down this path. You've started moving towards self-actualization, which is you know, if we just simply use Maslow's model, I mean, it's one of the certainly the highest planes we could reach in terms of our needs, desires, and who we are, and then we can help others start to self-actualize as well. So it's an honorable and ongoing pursuit to reach that ultimate level, that pinnacle, you might say. And of course, there's we don't know what's beyond that, but you can't get there, and you can't even begin the process. In fact, I'm absolutely certain that the moment you began the process, the moment you made the decision and asked the question, which was precisely, you know, what if this belief isn't true? Then the temptation to either stay there or go back presents itself. I call it the dragon in the leap of faith process. Because the dragon is that part of us, the part of our ego that stays buried in its cave, you might say, until we make a decision to change. Because it's the part of the ego that is comfortable right where we are. Mark, you had gotten painfully comfortable where you are. And the idea of changing, even dropping 15 pounds, was almost beyond possibility at that point. So it's almost impossible to start to move forward, to start to make some new decisions, adapt some new beliefs, and especially take action without that dragon showing up. So what was some of the temptations? What were some of the things that tried to pull you back and away from this pursuit of self-actualization along the way?
Well, let me tell you something. That dragon reared its ugly head a few times, Tom. So, you know, I talked a little bit about this before in other interviews, some with you, and I realize this might sound a little esoteric, and I don't mean for it to, but, Tom, I was inert in my ways of thinking, and I was inert in my ways of being. You know, the human race is the only species on this planet that identifies the right thing to do and then makes a conscious choice not to do it. You know, we will hit our head against the wall and complain about how much it hurts instead of just stopping. And so the biggest temptation was going back into what was familiar to me, what I had gotten comfortable with, instead of what was moving forward into what was best for me. Because obviously at that time I had a glimpse of what that looked like I said, from different times in my life, but I didn't have a clear-cut picture of what that was going to look like. I didn't know how that was going to show up for me. So the biggest temptation was, do I go back into this place that I've been where at least I know what to expect? It's predictable. Mm-hmm. I know what it looks like. I know what it's feel like. And you know what, Tom? I know where the shadows are, and I know where I can hide in there. That's probably the biggest temptation. That's the dragon, man, taking over and working its magic, casting its spell, right? And I'm like, every time that would happen, I'm like, you know what? I know where that goes. I've been there. I've seen that. I know what it feels like. It doesn't reflect who I am. And it showed up in different ways, you know. There was the late night temptation to go into overeating or binge eating, or like I said, I was abusing drugs and alcohol, man. So it was like, you know, my back doesn't hurt, but I've got these painkillers in front of me, and I've got some, you know, some booze. Now maybe that'll make me feel better. You know, it was all these little things that the mind plays tricks on you, man. And the dragon will use that stuff against you. It's like a Jedi mind trick. So it was, you know, through that meditation, when those times would come up, Tom, what I would do is I would sit down at my altar, and I would get still, and I would detach and quiet the mind, and I would detach from those thoughts. And then I got to the point where I'm like, what the heck am I thinking? You know, I can go back down that slippery slope, and I know exactly where that's going to take me. I can hit my head against the wall and complain about how much it hurts, or I can just call a friend. Or I can invite, you know, somebody who's going to be a good influence in my life right now to come into my space. Or I can ask, you know, whatever it is, it showed up in a couple of different ways. But I want to go back to what I said about is that I was inert, man. And once you finally break that inertia and you don't have to deal with those temptations, you can just look at the dragon and go, hey, you know what? You're in the wrong place, man. Go find somebody else to mess with. That's where the power is.
You know, it's so interesting because you and I have never talked about this, but this leap of faith process evolved over the last few years, and it was, you know, when someone said, well, you created this process? No, I most definitely did not create this process of taking a leap of faith, but this is the conscious taking of the leap of faith. It's creating a body rapport. It's being brutally honest. It's overcoming the temptation, the dragon, understanding it, and then ultimately the action based in faith. And it's so fascinating that you talk about the dragon in the way you do, because you said something that was so critical to what most people would not realize is the truth, which is you then speak to the dragon. You tell the dragon to go away. You tell the dragon to go find some other place. You get it to recede back. And in some respects, in a minute, we can even tame that dragon. We don't want to kill it, because remember, it's part of who we are. It's our ego, in many respects, right? It's the one that has come to believe the crusty truth and wants us to be there. We've programmed us to keep us there and safe. So we don't want to kill this thing. We don't want to slay the dragon. We want to tame the dragon. And you were able to do that through meditation, through strategies like calling a friend, finding a way of being around good influence, and then the dragon steps back, recedes back to its lair, and begins to also think, well, wait a minute, maybe this is not so bad, maybe this is not as uncomfortable as I thought it would be. It'll rear its head again later, certainly, but you make it think. The part of that ego that is the dragon begins to reevaluate, you might say, and adapt some new beliefs as you adapt yours. So that was critical when you said that we're talking about slaying the dragon.
I love where you're at with that, because you just touched on a really important point, because, you know, I've had a lot of people ask me about this process. Now, my Buddhist teacher used to call it the neurotic roommate, you know, that part of my egoic self that, you know, was always like, hey, what are you know, trying to derail me or whatever. I love the dragon analogy much better. But the point is that you're right. You get to that point where, and you've seen some of my posts on Facebook, and this comes up in my book. You don't, it's there. It's a part of you. It's integral. It's a matter of when you get to that point where you can keep it at bay, you can contain it. You know, we talk about that uncontrolled burn. There was a time in my lifetime when I was that uncontrolled burn. Now I can control that fire. I can control that darkness. And I'm grateful for it. Because in my belief system, Tom, everything is a reflection of something else. And we can only know this by knowing that. And as a result of going into that darkness inside myself and to facing that dragon, or what some might call facing their demons, I like the dragon metaphor better, now I can make a conscious choice to acknowledge that for what it is, to honor it, to embrace it, and then to tell it where to go, right? That's where
exactly.
The power is. Not
indeed,
a matter of
indeed.
Saying it's not there or it never existed, because it is. It's real, and it's in each of us.
Yeah.
But now we can make a conscious choice to allow it to have control over us and to even feed it or whatever, or we can tell it where to go.
Yep. Yeah, and it's so interesting because, again, think about how powerful the dragon is for most people. Most people who don't understand the process allow for their entire lives the dragon, or as you said, some others call the demons, but the dragon, to control them, to manipulate them, and to keep them stuck right where they are, unhappy, but comfortably unhappy, you might say, until they hit a point of rock bottom. And then it's not about understanding at that point. It's about change, an absolute must change. Most people don't realize that. They don't realize that the dragon can recede, that we can tame it. And we can be, you know, listen, you're an actor, Mark, and we haven't really touched base on some of the things that you do in terms of your writing, your acting, and the pursuits that you have. When we're done with this, when we're near the end of the call, I want to talk about the momentum you're creating towards what the future is, because having a vision for the future, and not just something that's, well, okay, that'd be cool, that's nice, but something that's, hey, listen, we're all adults, something that's fucking compelling, something that will get you up and moving and help you overcome that dragon and all the external opposition and resistance that you may or may not come up against. You've got to have something that's compelling. Mark has created a future that is indeed compelling. But let me ask you this, Mark, because this is something that we literally have just worked on. In fact, we're in the process right now, because I'm a big believer, obviously, and we're going to talk about the towards of goals and objectives, which is what you've created in many respects. But getting moving, creating a different inertia, getting up off the couch and taking some form of compelling action, and it may not be towards something, but it may be away. No more. I can't tolerate this anymore. I can't take this anymore. When you were in that fetal position at 455 pounds, you could not live with it any freaking longer. It's either freaking suicide or take some action. Something's got to change. Yes?
That's right. Yeah.
So we're working on this process now of rubbing salt on the wound. In many respects, we've been tolerating. Everyone on this call, you're in this process for a reason, because something's got to change right now. And I don't want that to dissipate the pain of what it is. Whatever the reason you got into this process, the reason you're on this call with us right now, there was some kind of pain that got you to take action. And many times in our lives, what happens is we take a little action. We join a mastermind group. We sign up for a gym. We hire a trainer. We get rid of the crap in our cupboards that we shouldn't be eating. And that feels like just enough to dissipate the pain to the point where we discontinue taking action. We cannot allow that to happen. You've got to continue that inertia. So in many respects, we've talked about that thing that we all tolerate, or the things that we tolerate or we accept in our lives. We kind of like, okay, it's good enough, or okay, or really, you know, whether conscious or unconscious, I'm not really worthy of any more than that, or I'm not good enough to be any better than that, or have any more than that. Rubbing the salt on the wound. What is it in your life now, Mark, that keeps you moving? What is it right now that's the away from that you will no longer, that as a result of this process, you will no longer tolerate, you will no longer accept in your life that you once believed was okay or good enough? What is it that keeps you moving forward from an away perspective? Because we're going to talk about the towards in a moment. What is it that's pushing you away from it that you will no longer tolerate?
Oh, that's such a great question, Tom. I guess if I were to say the one thing above all else is that the behavior that I was engaging in and that I will never go back to was behavior that was I was abusing myself, Tom. It was the self-sabotaging. It was the stuffing of whether it was food or it was drugs or it was alcohol. When I look back on it, Tom, it's almost I don't want to say it's laughable, but it's unbelievable to me that I was engaging in the kind of behaviors that I was in because I didn't have a willingness to be emotionally vulnerable and to be emotionally present. I was engaging in behaviors ultimately to distract me from whatever was going on in my little corner of the world, whatever was going on in my emotional, physical body, whatever was going on in my mood state, and especially with my dad, to distract myself away from the fact that my best friend had become a prisoner in his body and there was nothing I could do about it. I was all those things in which I felt powerless over, Tom, I was exerting control over another aspect of my life. And in this case, the choices I was making, the things I was exerting control over, were somewhere between really bad and ugly. And it was just killing me, right? So it was just, you know, pushing me further and further down into that darkness. So now, for the very first time in my life, since I'm not doing that and I'm not doing it in a sustainable way, I experience everything now in all its richness and all its fullness. You know, when I'm sad, I experience sadness. When I'm joyful, I experience joy. When I'm angry, man, I experience anger. I've developed very healthy and constructive ways in which to deal with that. But so, you know, now that I'm on the other side of that, one thing that I'm going to make sure that I never do is engage in any of those behaviors that are going to rob me of that experience, the healthy, you know, the constructive, the rich, and the fullness. I mean, I know that sounds really fundamentally simple, but that's where it was, man. That's where I was at. So that's something I'm never going to go back to, regardless of what it is, because sometimes it was, you know, food, sometimes it was drugs, sometimes it was alcohol, sometimes it was women, sometimes it was, you know, whatever. But I'm never going back to that stuff ever again.
It's interesting because I probably should have phrased it differently, because knowing your journey now, I know that though that not going back to that is still there. It's still, you know,
it's still in my consciousness. It's still an option,
still in the
consciousness.
Right? Yeah, right, absolutely. But it's not what continues to compel you. And I have a saying that fear and pain is a great place to start a journey because it will get us up and moving. But it's not the fuel that we want driving the journey, especially to the end. We don't want to. Obviously, you can't put out the type of positive energy. And as you said, you know, what we focus on expands in our lives. If all you're thinking about is the negativity of the possibility and the fear of going back to that, that's what you're going to attract more of. Yes. So
that's right.
It has to be a positive fuel, but that that no longer tolerating that, no longer accepting that is the inertia. It's sort of like the steam that gets the engine, the locomotive moving. And then once it's moving, once it's on the tracks, once we're headed towards a target, then it's the towards that keeps us moving. It's the towards
That's right.
that becomes the fuel. So let's talk about your towards, because you've got we've only got a few minutes left or so, but you've got some very compelling objectives. And then I want you just to share a little bit. We talked about this on last night's call with the radio call that we did, which was fantastic stuff. But I'll talk a little bit more about the vision board, how that plays a role in programming your mind towards moving towards those objectives, those goals. Tell us about what's next, man. What's happening?
Well, so to kind of dovetail on what you said about moving forward, that's it's simple physics. We talked about this a little bit last night. Energy flows where attention goes. So, you know, what I'm doing, obviously, is advancing, taking all the enthusiasm, the energy, the desire that I had, that I used in that first transformation, to advance every other aspect of my career, my life, who I am, my transformation, my health, my wellness, on all fronts moving forward, right? So what's on my vision board right now is I'm a guy who believes in playing my strengths. And my strength right now, as I see it, is in my career as a sponsored athlete. I'm shredding down to 7% body fat and 210 pounds under your expert supervision and guidance. There's a couple reasons that I'm doing that. It will advance my career not only as an athlete, because I'm passionate about climbing. I love mountaineering. I started climbing in my 20s. It'll get me into the kind of shape that I need to be in order to do some of the other ambitious things that I want to do as a climber, like you and I talked about early on, some things like the CrossFit Games. But it also ramps me up and will advance my career as an actor. So one of the things that's on my vision board, and that's an integral tool for me, has been and continues to be, is some climbs of peaks like Aconcagua and some of the other 7,000, 8,000-meter peaks. But, Tom, I'm going to go on record as saying that where I want this to land is I want the cover of Men's Health magazine. I want to be the guy who's morbidly obese at death's door to the cover of Men's Health magazine to show people how far one man can go on brute force, determination, fortitude, courage, resolve, with an expert team of professionals, mind you, but to show the investment that a person can make in their health and their well-being and their fitness, to take it from one end of the logical extreme over to the other end, and to do that under a mantle that inspires other people to be the best version of themselves that they can be, and then also, as an actor and as an athlete, the perfect trajectory for me to take then is to become the next American action hero. I mean, come on, what guy doesn't want to be a superhero? What guy doesn't want to be the next Jason Bourne or the next Batman, right? So we know this is possible. We know, you know, it's been done before. Look at people that have, you know, so it's just a matter of doing the work. And one of the things that I'm excited about with you is that what we've established now is, or rather what we are establishing is, okay, an action plan. So we know this is where we're at now. This is where we want to be. We know we can get there. What are the steps that we need to take in order to make sure that happens? What are the rungs along the ladder? Strategy is what you're going to do. Tactics is how you're going to do it. As long as you're continuing to move on that trajectory, moving forward and advancing things on all fronts, and you're walking your talk and you're living it, it will happen. It's just a matter of, for me, in my belief